Welcome to episode 42 of Girls on Pop. I am one of your hosts, Marina Antunes, joined today by fellow co-hosts.
I'm one of your other hosts, Ashley Lynch.
Okay, I swear to God, I've only had one drink. Not even a full drink.
Only one.
Only one. I swear to God. It kind of feels like maybe I've had three already, which I have not had.
We've reached that point in the summer where it's just like, yeah.
Day drinking is okay.
Yeah.
We have lots of stuff to talk about today, so I think we're gonna forgo the news. Not that there's anything really new to talk about, and let's jump into the movies.
Yeah, I mean the only thing new is like strike's still ongoing. They're still trying to like sweat out all of the labor, and yep. People are starting to talk about pushing release dates for films now. A bunch of movies have been pushed back into next year that weren't ready yet, like the as yet to be titled Ghostbusters sequel.
I saw that. I did hear some grumblings through the grapevine that there had been talks about moving the release dates of some of the big releases that are coming later this year, I guess because of marketing issues. I mean, if the actors can't promote, I guess there's some concern, but I haven't actually seen anything official. One of the ones people were talking about was Dune Chapter 2 or Part 2, but that hasn't moved, and I doubt it will. At this point, I think that commitment is made, and they're going to have to forge ahead one way or the other.
Yeah, I've heard that too, that like because the actors, according to the SAG strike rules, they can't do promotion for the films. Yeah. And because of that, the rumor that they're going to push some of the dates of movies that are coming out in the next couple months that are finished, but at the same time, they've already spent so much in advertising on these films. I'll believe it when I see it.
No, that's exactly it. I mean, not only have they spent the advertising dollars, they've made the theatrical commitments as well. And I mean, if we're talking just Dune, they've pretty much gobbled up every major screen and IMAX screen for basically until, you know, Christmas. Yeah. So that's kind of a hard thing to walk away on. The only other bit of news that I saw that I thought was rather amusing, Variety had a headline basically saying, noticing that plastic surgeon's office in Hollywood are a little busier than usual.
I did not see that one.
Quote unquote small procedures that, you know, on the face, which usually take a bit longer to heal. So some actors are taking, no names were mentioned in this article.
Got time between here and your next job to recover from any work you want to get done.
Yeah, that's right. Apparently eye lifts are quite the rage at the moment. But why don't we jump right into the movies? And there's a lot of stuff to talk about this week, and I think we'd be remiss not to at least mention the two big titles that were like sort of battling it. I don't know if it was really much of a battle at this point. I mean, it was clear from the get-go that Barbie was always going to make more money because it's the more widely appealing film. So why don't we start there with
Greta Gerwig's Barbie? It's also a movie that isn't 3.5 hours long.
Well, three hours.
So if you look at your local theater, you know, there's a lot more screenings of Barbie in a day than there are in Oppenheimer. So that means Barbie's going to make more money.
Oh, for sure. And I mean, it's a movie that has a wider appeal. I mean, I took my 7-year-old niece with me. We had a girls' day at the movies. We both really enjoyed it, though. Mm-hmm. Admittedly, I had way more fun than she did, and I laughed much more than she did. And I'm pretty sure she kept looking at me and I'm like, why is that funny? I'm like, I'll have to explain it to you when you're older.
Yeah, and so, I think that's the interesting thing about Barbie is there's a lot of material here that like it's got a certain amount of age gap where it's like, oh yeah, you kind of need some feminist theory or at least some basic feminist, you know, working theory about the world to fully grasp everything that this movie is doing. But it's, I don't know, I thought it was kind of brilliant.
I don't think it's kind of brilliant. I think it's fully brilliant. And I think you're totally right. This movie is one of those rare, like we all often talk about how movies play on multiple levels. And a lot of the times kids' movies are kind of playing on, you know, they play to the kid and they play to the adult in different ways. But this one, I think, is playing on even multiple levels beyond that because it's highly enjoyable for kids because it is bright and poppy and fun. And there's like this adventure component to it. And it's not a movie that has like a lot of big words or, you know, concepts that are ungraspable, But at the same time, like you mentioned, it's also a film that plays really well if you have some form of understanding of the world at large and feminism at large and kind of where we are in the world today. But even beyond that, it also plays to like this nostalgia factor that if you grew up in the 90s, you probably totally dig into. I mean, I thought some of the song choices were hilarious. Some of the commentary was so funny. Like, it's just such a smart movie, like on all levels. It plays so well. And it's super fun. Like, it's actually a lot of fun to watch.
And I thought the base conceit, like, I don't want to go in like too much into stuff that will be spoilery for people who haven't seen it, but the very base conceit of the movie, I think, is such a brilliant place to start from, which is this idea that, like, you have Barbie in Barbie land, and there's all these multiple Barbies, and it's basically like it's all the Barbies that have been released as toys over the years, right down to some ridiculous versions. Like, here's a Barbie with a camera in her chest and a TV on the back, and she even acknowledges, like, who even wants me? This makes no sense at all, but like, this was a product that existed. And so you have like the Barbie land where they all live, and they kind of all acknowledge and accept that they are toys living in a toy world, but they're completely happy and content with their toy world. And because they exist there and they are aware of the existence of the real world, they believe that their idealized world of female empowerment in Barbie land has solved feminism in the real world. That is the base conceit they're operating under. And that is kind of like the bubble that gets popped for the dolls in the world that essentially completely changes their world. And I thought that was such a fascinating place to start from. And because you're doing it through the perspective of, or through the lens of these toys in a toy world that have such a limited perspective on the world and are fairly one-dimensional characters by design, because they're not really characters, they're ideas, they're concepts. And because of that, you get to examine the basically deconstruct gender roles for both men and women through this lens in a way that is enjoyable and entertaining and comedic and satiric, and also has something important to say.
It's really genius. Like, it really is genius. And I'm not even I'm not being facetious about it. Like, I really think it's like one of the smartest movies I've seen this year. And we're going to talk about Oppenheimer in a minute, but it's just grasping at some like really big concepts and these really like easily digestible ways that you can either, like, depending on where you are in your lot in life, you can take like a whole bunch of different readings into it. And it really works for that reason. Like I say, 7-year-old niece loved it. 40-something-year-old auntie loved it. Like, it's a movie that fully embraces what it is. And what it is like a really smart feminist manifesto. Yeah. The fact that it comes from a toy company is, I don't know. I have mixed feelings because
save. It's like, I love that Greta Gerwig made this film. I love that she's enjoying all the success. I love that this film is brilliant. And the fact that there's no way this isn't going to be in the top five of my year. And this may end up being the number one favorite movie of the year for me. And I kind of hate that it's a fucking Barbie movie that is that.
Yeah,
it's so weird. It feels like I'm in such conflict about the fact that, like, it's a toy commercial, but it's also an absolutely brilliant film.
Yeah, and I mean, I feel a little less gross about it, maybe because I've made my peace with Mattel. I made my peace with Mattel like 20 years ago when I became a Barbie collector, and I do collect. I do have a small collection of Barbies. So I've embraced that part of it, but I can't help but feel like a little bit of ickiness at the fact that, you know, this is basically being marketed to death for everything under the sun is now Barbie. On the one hand, I'm like, this is great because I love pink and I can now get anything I want in pink. On the other hand, I'm like, does a corporation really need any more money? Probably not.
Oh, and the screenings are so much fun. I don't know what it's like for you, but when I went to the theater, I've never seen so much pink at once in my life. Everyone was dressed up in pink. And then later the next week when we went to go see Oppenheimer, I come out into the lobby after the movie and there's just like all this pink.
Yes, which you can is always weird tell.
After Oppenheimer.
And yeah, it's like, strange.
The Barbie audience is here.
Yeah, exactly. Because I mean, even like a week or two later, like people are still going out. And it's turned into this kind of like invent movie, which I think is awesome. Awesome. And this is what happens when you market movies to women. Mm-hmm. If they're Absolutely. Good, we embrace them.
And my hope is, like, I've seen a whole bunch of, like, you know, this is one of the most successful weekends for a female-directed film. This is one of the most successful films for a female-directed film. And I think that's great. But it's, like, my hope is that we get enough kind of unbridled successes like this that we can stop framing in those terms and just accept it as being normal that women make very highly performing movies as well.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's a win from both of us. Highly recommended.
Yeah, absolutely.
if you haven't seen it already, we highly recommend that you do. And let's talk about that at the other movie that came out at the same time, which it turned into this whole big to-do, and that's Oppenheimer, which is Christopher Nolan's new film on Robert Oppenheimer and the atomic bomb. I want to say, like, when the lights came up on this, and I didn't go reluctantly. Like, I wanted to see this movie. Mm. On the one hand, I'm like, I don't want to support Christopher Nolan because I kind of find him a bit douchey. Like, he's just this kind of uppity filmmaker who feels like he's like this man's
he's
man
a director. Purist.
It's not even...
I will only shoot everything on film. There's no VFX in my film. He doesn't have that accent that I'm doing right now, but it just feels appropriate.
But I don't know if that's saying like he's a purist. I kind of feel like he's just douchey about it. Like he's this guy that's made a bunch of movies that have been really successful, and he kind of has free reign to do whatever he wants. And he like lords it over everybody. Like, I'm only going to do this. And I mean, that's fine. And don't get me wrong, I appreciate his level of filmmaking, and I've liked the majority of the films. He irritates me to no end. Like, this idea that things can only be this one way, and if they don't fit into this very narrow category, then they're not really authentic films. I don't know. Like, the whole thing drives me off the wall. But that said, the lights came up on Oppenheimer and the credits were still rolling, and I was sitting in my seat and I'm like, well, fuck him. He did it again. this movie is super impressive on... Ooh. Many, many, many levels. What did you think?
I really enjoyed this film. I thought it was great. There's a lot of things I love from it. Brilliant performances, as you would expect, both from Cillian Murphy in the title role, but also like Robert Downey Jr., who was just like unrecognizable. It's like 20 minutes in before I was like, holy shit, is that Robert Downey Jr.? And he's like acting his ass off in this movie. I thought it was really compelling. I thought the editing in this movie was god tier, because what the movie takes this approach. There are very few scenes in the movie that are just like, here's a full scene, and it's not told linearly. Instead, what you get are a lot of fragments of scenes that you will sort of like return to repeatedly and are shown out of order, which create kind of this lyrical pastiche montage that gets at the emotion or the idea of what they want to be telling, rather than doing any type of storytelling that is, and then this happened, and then this happened, and then this happened. So as a result, the movie is time jumping constantly, but you never really get lost. And it has such a lyricism and sort of melody to the rhythm of it that it's just like, I was in awe of the film on that level. I think it's a masterpiece in that regard. The only place where the movie really kind of fell down for me is that it's basically, you got three stories here. You have sort of like a biography of Oppenheimer as he's basically, you know, coming up in the world of theoretical physics. And then you have the whole trying to solve the problem of, you know, building this bomb to try to stop the Nazis, which eventually ends up getting used on Japan, and then like the detonating of the bomb and the aftermath of dealing with the moral ramifications of that. And then this whole last third of the film that is all the political witch hunt against Oppenheimer at the benefit of politicians who want to use him to kind of leapfrog off of. And unfortunately, I was far less interested in that last third of the film. I just didn't find it compelling, you know, compared to what came before. And I understand that that's like his story, but as an audience member for a movie that's 3 hours long, and it's already like that's, and the last part of the film is the part that is like disengaging me. And that's the part where I was starting to check my watch and started to like not really be into the film anymore.
I think you nailed the editing. And I mean, this is not something new for Christopher Nolan. He like, this is one of his trademarks, is the fact that he doesn't really tell linear stories. He often jumps around in time. It's just a construct of your mind. I find that here it's probably done to the greatest effect of any of his previous films. I think it's handled the best, because you never lose sight of where you are within the story. And it really is about the emotional beats. And it feels much more linear in that way, even though that time-wise, it's not a linear story. I actually thought that the political intrigue is really key to the messaging of the story, because one of the things that struck me as the credits were running is that this is probably one of the better anti-war movies I've seen in some time. And I had a conversation with Dan in the car, and I'm like, this feels a lot like Dr. Strangelove, and that it's a movie about a war, but it really is about how wars are not a good thing. And I found that the political discussion played really well into sort of the latter part of Oppenheimer's career, where he was kind of fighting the establishment as the father of the atom bomb is now saying, you know, weapons of mass destruction are not a thing that anybody should have. And it does, I think that it starts to sort of peel away at the moral issues of the story, which I find intriguing. I had another conversation with somebody else that was telling me that they had seen a lot of TikTok videos, and one of the things that's coming up as sort of a criticism is that the movie is very anti-American. And then there was this whole conversation about, well, you know, if the Americans hadn't gotten the atomic bomb first, if it had been the Germans, the world would be a different place. I'm like, well, we'll never need to know, right?
Yeah.
But then you start making the parallels to where we are today with other weapons and other technologies. And so if nothing else, I think the film is ripe for discussion. And the themes that it presents, I think, are really timely and important. But on a filmmaking level, this might well be the best made film I've seen this year. Like you say, the editing is top notch. The performances are outstanding. The script is really kind of brilliant, because if you mm-hmm. watch the film, I'm really looking forward to seeing it again, because the use of dialogue is so limited. Like, there's very little dialogue in the film. And so when anybody is talking, you can't help but pay attention. For me, I think the weakness is Florence Pugh's character, which I understand is important for the development of Oppenheimer as a character. Mm-hmm. I just found those scenes to be like unnecessary, like the nude scenes that everybody was going on about. I didn't care for them. Like, I didn't see why they needed to be in the nude. I didn't understand why there was that scene a bit later in the interrogation room. I didn't get it. I'm like, that seems really like, we know, like, I know what you're getting at here. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't need to show it to me. It just, the whole thing felt kind of like icky. But beyond that, it's kind of genius. And the fact that he's managed to achieve so much of this with practical effects is really impressive. As much as I think it's kind of stupid to make such a big deal about it, The reality of it is, it looks really impressive. Like, really, really impressive.
Also, I think he's, it's sort of come out that he's making a bigger deal of it than he should be.
Yeah.
About there being no CGI in the movie, because... Yeah. when you dig into it, Dienig did a whole lot of VFX work on this film. And I guess to try to maintain this illusion that it's all done practically, they actually didn't credit a lot of the VFX artists in the credits.
And this pisses me off to no end, because and this was a sticking point for me, because somebody else posted the credits and literally there are 27 VFX artists credited in the film. And I'm like, there is no way in this universe that only 27 people worked on this thing.
There's hundreds of people that did VFX on this.
Exactly. And it irks me because, I mean, at least Top Gun had the decency to credit the artists that did the work.
Yeah.
Yes, a lot of it was practical. And for sure, you know, rally behind that. Rally behind the stuff that you actually did practically. But you have to give credit where credit is due. And the fact that they managed to, however they managed it, to get away with that really pisses me off.
Yeah.
really pisses me off.
And this is where that elitism that you were talking about earlier about Chris Nolan, I agree. I find it so pretentious and off-putting.
Pretentious is
and pretentious. And makes me want to root against him rather than for him.
This is it. And I mean, it would be so much easier if the movies weren't good.
I know.
But the reality is the movies are actually pretty good. So, I mean, I'm curious to read more about it. I have started looking a little bit about like the making of, and I've seen some interviews with the science team that was involved. Kip Thorne was involved in as a science advisor. And I mean, there's some really interesting little tidbits, as there always are with movies like this. And actually, even with Barbie, there's a great behind the scenes video. I'll see if I can find it, where the whole like traveling between worlds is actually like practical.
Yes, I saw that.
And I thought, you know, this kind of stuff is just so cool to see, these behind the scenes things.
Absolutely.
So I'm curious to see more from both of them about, you know, the actual making of the movies. But reluctantly, I thought Oppenheimer was really kind of brilliant. And I will probably see it.
I liked it a lot too. I liked it more than I thought I would.
I definitely like the
only thing I'll say, and I'm not going to hold this against the film at all, but unfortunately, the theater that I saw it in, they had a speaker that was basically like blown in the theater, so there was this subwoofer that like anytime it like hit that lower register was just like rumbling and rattling and popping. And I know the movie's not supposed to sound like that. And unfortunately, there's a lot of lower register like rumbling, because it's like not just when the big boom goes off, but at, like I was talking about with the editing, how it's like this constant sort of montage. They layer in like just like they're just like random explosion that's like under every sort of scene. It just like colors this entire life sort of thing. And so it was constant throughout the film, and it was very off-putting. Eventually I tuned it out, but it made for not a great viewing experience.
I
toughed it out despite that.
Yeah.
Definitely not the way that you should see this film, but that was unique to the one theater I happened to watch it in.
We did try to make the trip to the park because I wanted to see it in 70, but it just didn't work with our schedule. And I wanted to make sure I saw it before I left for LA. So we kind of just picked the screening in the middle of the day and we went to see it on Friday. Otherwise we definitely would have made the trip out to see it on film. And I think if it sticks around long enough, or if it comes back over the holidays, I would make the trip to see it on film, just because I think it would play slightly different on film.
I mean, it very may well, because like depending on how long this strike goes on, eventually, once we get to October, we're going to run into a situation where theaters just are dry for content. And that's when we're going to start to see, we're still playing Oppenheimer.
Yeah, pretty much. I don't want to spend too long on this because we talked a little bit about it on the last show, but I did finally get to see Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1. And I just want to say it is as good as you said it was. I mean, I didn't doubt it. Do not get me wrong, but I had to see it because it is Mission Impossible and because it is Christopher McQuarrie. And it's so good. It is just so good. Like, and the fact that it's so timely, even though it was delayed by the pandemic, is bonkers to me. So just imagine if this had come out when it was supposed to come out. It would have been ahead of the AI game. And we all would have been like, what the fuck, Pac-Man, they predicted the future. Like, it's just mind-boggling.
It's really wild. You sit down, you watch a trailer for The Creator, which is coming out, which is all about a war against AI, and then you roll right into Mission Impossible, where it's all about a rogue AI, and it's like, fuck, it's coming for all of us. It's all the actors are on strike about AI being used. It's like... It's too much.
It's a lot. It's a lot. But that movie is so much fun. And it's disappointing that it's lost so many screens over the course of like three or four weeks because of the big openings. But I mean, it was bound to happen.
And also, unfortunately, just coming out a week before like these two gigantic movies, which basically fed each other into becoming like a cultural explosion, which benefited both Oppenheimer and Barbie.
For sure.
But because of it, it means that Mission Impossible really kind of got pushed out of the limelight.
It did okay. It made a lot of money, so I'm not super worried about it. Let's talk a little bit about Joyride, which I haven't seen, but I've heard nothing but good things about. So talk to me a little bit about this film.
Yeah, this just came out on VOD. I didn't get a chance to see it in the theater. And unfortunately, I don't think it did that great. I think it probably... was not helped by being like another female-led raunchy comedy following the Jennifer Lawrence one.
No Hard Feelings?
No Hard Feelings. The most forgettable title in the world. So this one came out like a month later while, you know, No Hard Feelings was still in theaters. It's like two female-led raunchy comedies. I love that we have them, but like I think they're probably in competition with each other a bit. But this movie is about two Chinese Americans, one of which doesn't know her birth parents, was adopted from China when she's really young, lives with a white family and whatnot. And she has the opportunity for work to go to China and close a deal. And her friend goes with her with sort of like the intention of trying to track down her birth mother while they're there. And they go on this whole adventure and they hook up with two other friends and, you know, get into so much trouble along the way, as you would expect from this type of movie. It's crude, it's crass, it's over the top, it's going for, you know, it's a sex-com movie. It's one of those. And it's also really, really funny. I absolutely love the hell out of this movie. And because of its perspective, it manages to get into a lot of situations that I've just never seen on film before. Because mostly when you see this type of film, and here's the thing that's been great about this year, 2023, because we have two of them, is it's usually from the male perspective. We don't get a lot of raunchy sex comedies from the female perspective. And so you end up in something where all the sex is centered around female pleasure to lead into situations I've never seen. Have you ever seen two footballers go down on a girl at the same time? I haven't. I've never seen that in a feature film before, but I saw it in this film. Amongst other things that I don't want to spoil. And there are some moments in this movie that are like the legit kind of bid for immortality moments where it's like, holy fuck, I've never seen that in a movie before. I can't believe they went there. And this movie has a few of those, and some of them like really catch you off guard. And it's like, I absolute joy. I love this movie. Definitely check this one out.
Well, you're like the fourth person that has told me this is really good. So, you know, I'm going to be watching it sooner rather than later.
Absolutely.
I caught up with Bird Box Barcelona, and I'm still not 100%. Actually, I lie. I know exactly why I watched this. The Pastor Brothers made Carriers, which is a zombie movie that came out a number of years ago with Chris Pine, which I really liked. Mm-hmm. So I was like, oh, those names sound familiar. And I mean, I actually liked the first Bird Box. Like, I have no qualms about the fact that I thought it was an interesting concept and I thought it was pretty well executed. This is a mess, I guess. I don't even know. Like, There is so much that you could do with this concept. I mean, the fact that the universe, this universe exists is interesting enough. So, and the way that the first story is told, it has like, it has the open door that you could do whatever you want within this concept. And so they pick up the story in Barcelona at the exact time that this thing is unfolding is kind of where it starts. And then it goes elsewhere. But that elsewhere is just like, it's so weird. Like, I just don't get it. It just makes zero sense. I was, in some parts, I was like, wow, that's really cool. And, and then another part is like, this is so stupid. It's just a mess. It's just a fucking mess. It's a mess.
So I watched this too. I had actually not seen Bird Box before.
What? Did you watch Bird Box first?
I did.
Okay.
But I passed over Bird Box originally because it just looked like, oh, apparently, you know, Quiet Place was a success. So we're just doing like all versions of these. Like, what sense can we just like rob from people and then like make a movie about a creature? But then I found out it's like, oh, it's actually not that. It's actually more of like a cosmic horror type of thing. Cause it's about like all of a sudden there's these creatures that appear and we never see them or even know what they are. All we know is that when people look at them, they just instantly all kill themselves. And
it's The Happening all over again.
It's The Happening. And it's probably the most effective part of The Happening, like just seeing people. I've low-key defended The Happening for years, not as a good movie, but just the fact that this element of seeing people dispassionately mass commit suicide is genuinely unsettling and horrifying. And
I thought
that was really effective, even if the rest of the movie is fucking stupid.
Agreed.
And Bird Box basically does that exact same thing, but does it in the form of a good movie. And I watched Bird Box first, and it's like, okay, I actually quite dig this. This is a really cool concept, and it's, you know, original and pretty terrifying, and I think it's well done. And Bird Box Barcelona basically picked up that same thing, but like the thing that gets introduced in the first movie is that while people who gaze upon these creatures will kill themselves, there's like 0.5% of the population or whatnot that don't kill themselves, but instead just become zealots. And you know, they are now convinced that they need to go around and make everyone else see. And that's what they do. And that's the weird place where Bird Box Barcelona comes in, because our protagonist, we very kind of quickly get this reversal and find out, oh, he's not going around with his daughter trying to survive like we thought. His daughter is dead and he's already gazed upon these things and he's turned into a zealot. And his daughter is basically just this like ghost that's prodding him along and convincing him he needs to basically find enclaves of survivors and doom them all. And he does that. He is responsible for a whole lot of deaths because he's basically on this mission. It's until but like halfway through the movie that he starts to sort of question this zealotry that he's been indoctrinated into and try to fight against it. But because of that, we don't like our protagonist. He's not doing things we want him to be doing. And he is like, it's like, where are we going? His conflict is how many people can I kill? And I want to say that the movie has really challenged itself to say, how far can you go with a character like this and still keep the audience on board? And I think they are kind of able to do it, but they sacrifice so much in the process by taking that route, in the fact that like you want him to fail. You want him to meet a bad end. And I think the movie eventually towards the end gets to like a better spot, but like the first half of the movie is a real tough ride because of that.
You bring up an interesting point, and I actually have forgotten that the Zealots were introduced in that first movie, because I did not remember that. Yeah. So this makes a little bit more sense, but still, I think you're totally right. It's the fact that he's such an unlikable protagonist that makes it difficult to follow the movie in the first half. I agree with you. I think the second part is better and more interesting, and I think it leaves in an interesting spot. I'm just unsure that I'd want to see the Pastors take on another story in this universe, because I don't feel that it would be interesting.
Yeah.
They managed to mess this one up, and I'm just not sure that they could take on a second one and make it any better. But I'm also afraid that this is going to turn into The Walking Dead, where we're just going to have iteration after iteration after iteration of these stories that are all basically the same, and they just get boring after a while.
Yeah, it was probably better off as more of a one and done thing. I appreciate that they tried to take this in a different direction, do something else with it, because it would be very easy to just do like, okay, let's go to a different city, different set of survivors, and see how they're handling it. Because as a survival story, it's inherently interesting. And because it's dealing with cosmic horror stuff, it's like, there's genuine intrigue and fear to be had there. But at the same time, there really isn't a hell of a lot more than was in the first film. The first film kind of covered all the ground that you can cover with this premise. And beyond that, it's just like more stories from this world. It's like, okay. And I guess if the stories are good enough, maybe, but they're... The only thing it's going to do is water down the premise and sort of take power away from it. And I sort of felt that in this movie. It's like, it wasn't scary at any point.
Yeah.
Whereas I did feel that kind of sense of terror in the first film. And it's, I don't know, it would have to be a version where I actually like cared about the people.
Yeah, pretty much. I will say it looked really good. It looked really, really good.
Yeah.
It's a really good looking movie. Okay, again, something else I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on. I have a feeling we may have talked about this already. I'm actually not 100% sure, but The Flash. I finally saw The Flash.
I don't think we did talk about this.
Okay.
I saw it too.
I don't know how I feel about The Flash. I actually do know how I feel about The Flash. I like The Flash. I thought The Flash was a lot of fun. Or is it just called Flash? I don't even know now.
I think it's The Flash.
Okay. Honestly, it doesn't really matter. I thought it was fun. I don't understand the derision. You know, it brings up again this question of, you know, how do you overlook a troubled artist and appreciate the art? Because I do think that he's actually pretty good here. I don't know. I had fun. I thought it was not... I don't know. I thought it was fun. I don't even know what else to say. It's not a stupid movie. Like, the way people are talking about it, I was expecting this to be like the worst thing ever. I didn't think it was terrible. I thought it was better than Justice League. I certainly enjoyed it a lot more. I thought Ezra Miller is like really captivating and engaging, playing two characters very well, because they are actually different people and different characters. And man, like... I don't know. It's great. It's great. Michael Keaton is back. What do you not like about Michael Keaton being back as Batman? I don't know. I thought it was great. I really did enjoy it a lot. It's not making my top 10 or anything.
Okay.
But I thought it was a lot of fun.
Oh boy, I feel like we saw totally different movies.
I fully, fully realized that I am like the very small minority of people that enjoy this. I did think it was fun. I did do a Google search to find out if the bits with Michael Shannon were taken from, would have been Man of Steel?
Would have been Man of Steel.
Yeah. I'm like, did he actually come back to reprise the role, or have they just like pulled bits from Man of Steel and done some CG stuff? Like, I thought that was not great. And I mean, he's already said publicly that he didn't really enjoy the process of being back for this movie. But besides the point, all of these superhero movies always have like a third act that fails rather miserably. This one I didn't think was quite as egregious as some of the others. But please tell us, how is The Flash so terrible?
I absolutely hated this movie. I hate everything about this movie. This movie is a hate crime.
Oh,
it was so awful. It's probably shorter to just talk about the things that I actually liked in the movie. I liked Kara in the movie. I thought she was good and interesting. And there's like one or two scenes with her that are like, I thought were genuinely good, which are the only one or two scenes in the movie at all that are not actively bad. I liked seeing Michael Keaton, but I hated seeing Michael Keaton as Batman again. And I think he's enjoyable just because Michael Keaton is inherently enjoyable, but trying to pander to any nostalgia I have for 89 Batman at this point is like, why are we doing this? It was so goofy and I hated it. And then we get to, I was more or less just ready to write off the movie as a movie I just disliked and was not enjoyed. And then we get to the climax of the film, where they pull off one of the most horrifically looking bad CGI sequences, where they want to pull in every character from DC history, including a CGI Christopher Reeve that mugs to the camera. That was basically the point at which I went from being benignly disliking of a movie to actually shouting obscenities at the TV. I hated it so much. It was awful. It's like whoever agreed to that decision should never work again, in my opinion. I know I'm being really harsh. And then follows up with a CGI Nicolas Cage battling a giant spider, because that's the one thing we all know about his aborted Superman Lives movie.
And I think you are absolutely right. That whole time travel circle parallel universe thing and how it plays out, it's so terrible. It looked bad too.
And it's like the movie tried to play it off like it was an aesthetic choice to just have everything look uncanny valley while it was inside that sort of Speed Force time travel bubble, but it doesn't. It just looks like unfinished VFX.
Yeah, but that's not the only scene that's problematic. Like are like the scenes that with Michael whole Shannon cold
open with the babies looked bad too.
And I mean the whole that I didn't think looked quite as bad, but there are some really bad looking moments in this movie, and I don't know. I mean, I think in part it's probably a result of the fact that they had probably overspent already and they're like, we're not giving you any more money. And it could also be the fact that maybe Andy Muschietti just hasn't worked with a lot of VFX, so he just didn't know. Like, I think it's a combination of things.
I think they just didn't want to spend more money because throwing good money after bad at a certain point.
And this is it. The thing that I feel like really bad about is, I mean, I fully agree. There are bad parts about this movie, which I am happy I can easily overlook because I did have fun watching it. I think the disappointing thing for me is that this is the movie that's going to mark the end of like this part of the DC universe. Yeah. And it's at least such a sour taste because it's not great.
Yeah.
Yes, I fully realize I had fun, but it is not a good movie. Like, I won't defend it on that level. Yeah. But I will say I had a fun time watching it. So I don't know.
Between Black Adam and The Flash, this basically marks the final nail in the coffin that is the Snyderverse. It's done and over at this point.
I hate that we call it that, because when you look at it, he only made like three movies out of the entire thing.
Yeah, but it's an extension of all the stuff from those films.
But see, the reason I dislike that is it writes off the achievements of Wonder Woman, and it writes off the good parts of the Snyder films, and kind of lumps everything into this like meddling terribleness that it is not. I don't know. That's just a personal thing. I think
going forward, they're going to take the stuff that works and the stuff that doesn't work. They can still take, you know, Gal Gadot, Wonder Woman, and just move it into like a different. She can exist in a different tone that is not, you know, the grim dark Snyderverse.
Oh yeah, and I mean, and that's where she's existed with the two Wonder Woman films, right? Yeah. They've existed in their own little bubble, which is, and the movies that work in the DC universe of the last like 15 years are the ones that like take a chance. And are their own movies.
Yeah, I mean, the ones that I like the best, you know, even though people didn't seem to connect with the sequel, but the movies I've enjoyed the most were the Shazam movies.
Yeah, yeah, I fully agree. I fully agree. I don't know. On the one hand, I'm just upset that this is the movie that ends this entire thing. I really hope for the best, but I'm also thinking, like, I might just be done with comic book movies, period. I'm just done. Like, DC is over for me now. Mm-hmm. Marvel has been over for me for a while. So I'm like, okay.
It feels like we're rounding that corner. And the fact that we had like this massive success with, you know, Barbie and not a superhero movie. And the fact that some of the Marvel movies have not been performing that great this year. Some have, but some haven't.
Yeah.
You know, it feels like culturally we're sort of turning that moment where superheroes are now on the downslope.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not against a good movie.
Just in time for James Gunn to wrap up a whole new cinematic universe.
Right. And I'm not against superhero movies as a whole. Yeah. Just give me something good and interesting and different, and I'll be happy. Netflix dropped The Tudor a couple of weeks ago. And, you know, generally this would be something that would be totally under the radar for me. I really wouldn't care much for it, having watched the trailer and read the description, I was like, okay, this doesn't really do anything for me. The only reason I watched it is because Garrett Hedlund is awesome. He's a really talented, underappreciated actor. And I will always watch anything that he's in. I kind of wish I'd skipped this one because it's not good. It really is not good. So the basic concept is Garrett Hedlund plays this tutor. This is his job. He teaches kids and he's really good at his job. And then his wife is pregnant, so they need extra money. So he takes this job doing a tutoring gig at this private residence for like a week. And they're going to pay him like $5,000 to be there for the week to teach this kid like 1 hour a day. He gets there. Turns out the kid is actually really smart. He doesn't really need help. So why is he there? Mystery to unravel. Snooze fest, total snooze fest. The mystery is stupid. The performances are mediocre at best, and the reveal is downright terrible. I just skip it. Don't waste your time. Garrett Hedlund, I love you. Please don't make any more of these. This is so bad. It's so bad. Just ignore it. It never happened.
I hadn't even heard about this movie.
You're not missing anything. Just pretend you never heard of it.
Okay.
Let's talk about something else that appeared on Netflix to me kind of out of nowhere. Cause I was like, what the fuck is this? And we're going to talk about They Clone Tyrone, which I don't even know. I mean, I don't even know. The title of this movie is fucking ridiculous. The movie is fucking ridiculous, but it's also kind of brilliant.
Yeah.
It's kind of brilliant.
It's a lot of fun. It's so flavorful. It's working on multiple genre levels, and it has actually like genuine, real social commentary that's buried underneath it. It's like, to me, this feels like what sci-fi as a genre was really kind of like meant for. Was like, let's take this one thing that we want to talk about and then deal with it in this fantastical allegory and expand it that way. And I thought this movie is like really kind of brilliant in some of the stuff that it does.
Yes.
And it tells it in a way which, like, you kind of know exactly what the movie is right from the title. They kind of like, you know, give away the games like for what the movie is doing. But it also just has like such a sense of freshness to it, both in like the characters that we're being presented with, the visual language that's being used in the film, the dialogue in the film. And it feels very unique. And it feels very, very kind of authorial, if that's the correct way to say it. Just like, I feel real voice behind this film that feels like they specifically nailed exactly what they were going for. And it's always interesting and exciting whenever you come across a film that feels like it's telling you a story in a way that you don't see every other story told, and it is exactly how they wanted to tell it to you.
Yeah, it feels very specific, and like you say, of a voice. And the fact that it manages to be so successful just goes to show how great this director is. I mean, admittedly, the movie is really cemented by some really top-notch performances. I don't think I've seen Jamie Foxx this good in years. Yeah. Like, he is top-notch Jamie Foxx here. He's like, he just chews screen like there's no tomorrow, but not in this like grandiose over-the-top way. Like, some of his choices are so small. He shines. He's so good. I said to Dan, I cannot believe this is Jamie Foxx. Like, it both is and feels like nothing like Jamie Foxx. He is so good here. I was so surprised, so pleasantly surprised by how good this movie is. And it looks like a 70s blaxploitation movie. Like, it opens and you're like, is this what the whole thing is going to look like? This is kind of amazing. it has like this flavor and this voice that's so new and unique. Mm-hmm. Loved it. What a surprise. Yeah. What a surprise.
I absolutely loved it. Yeah. And all the performances across the board, I thought were great.
Yes. Yes. And it's just so unexpected. And I think the thing I like the most about it is that at no point did I kind of like, yes, you know, the overall, like you say, the title gives it away. Mm. They're not hiding anything, but I didn't actually know what was going to happen from scene to scene, which I thought was really interesting.
That's why I've been kind of vague-ish about it, because it still goes places that you're not really expecting, even if, you know, like overarching, it's like, okay, I kind of get where this is headed. It's still going to take a lot of kind of side trips in places that you're really not expecting it to go. And it is a really kind of fun journey through a completely batshit story that has genuine heart and meaning behind it.
We thought this would make a great double bill with Get Out.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It would totally do good with that.
I watched, I don't know if you've seen this, I watched Robots on Amazon Prime. The only reason I watched this is because I really like Shailene Woodley. Mm-hmm. I think she's a really interesting actress and she tends to select really interesting projects. And the concept here is kind of fun. So we're in like a future universe, not that far in the future, but there's a future where cloning technology exists, but it's not allowed. But these two people have cloned themselves for their own reasons. The clones meet and fall in love, and then the owners of the clones have to track down their clones for reasons. And it turns into this like chase kind of heist, I guess, movie, because the clones have basically stolen themselves. And it has a lot of potential for it to be really fun. It doesn't manage to be a lot of fun. Like, it just feels like it has zero energy, which I haven't quite figured out, because the performances are actually really interesting, because you have Shailene Woodley and Jack Whitehall, both really great actors, playing basically two versions of themselves. They're like human selves and they're robot selves, which have emotions. But like, the movie just feels really disjointed. Like, it just has zero energy. It kind of just goes through the motions, and it has some funny moments. And it's supposed to be a comedy, but it doesn't manage to like carry any of the laughs through for any extended period of time. Like, it just feels vacant. And the ending is supposed to be like, I get that the ending is supposed to be like emotionally powerful and revealing. It's not. It just kind of feels stupid and lame. So I'd say it's another skip. I didn't think it was very good. I'm sad.
That's too bad. I saw the trailer and it didn't really grab me enough to want to catch up with it. So it kind of slipped me by. Sounds like my instincts were probably correct.
Yes, you are absolutely right. Let's talk about The Wrath of Becky, because I know, I mean, I've seen Becky. I haven't seen the follow-up. So talk a little bit about how good this one is, because I assume it's probably pretty fun.
So Becky is a movie from a few years ago where basically she's up at a cabin with her father and his new wife and a bunch of neo-Nazis led by Kevin James, of all people. Which is part of like the fun of that movie is it's Kevin James playing a skinhead neo-Nazi.
This is how I got Dan to watch it, was I said Kevin James and he's like, okay, I'll watch it.
Yeah. And Becky is basically just like this young kind of socially aberrant girl who, you know, maybe has like some naturally malicious tendencies kind of thing. And so we end up with like essentially a John Wick situation where it's like a bunch of bad guys come to like, you know, fuck up her home, and who's going to stand up and take out all these neo-Nazis in the most over the top violent and sadistic way possible. It's going to be this like 12-year-old little girl named Becky. And that's kind of like the chief sort of like comedic, you know, backbone behind Becky and why that movie is fun, because it's a little girl that is basically just going on a murder spree against a bunch of people who you don't feel bad getting watched murdered in increasingly graphic ways. And Wrath of Becky is the exact same thing. It just picks up years later. Becky is now this girl who's gone from foster home to foster home and keeps escaping and has basically like trained herself as a survivalist. And then one day has a chance encounter with this movie universe's analog of the Proud Boys, the leader of which is played by Sean William Scott. And it is 100% the Proud Boys. They call themselves the Noblemen. And their logo is exactly the same as the Proud Boys. So it's like, you know exactly who these fuckers are. And they all talk like they're like 4chan incels. And it's like, it is so kind of spot on in satirizing who the Proud Boys actually are. And that's when we get into, they basically attack her. They kill her foster guardian and they steal her dog. And then now we're in John Wick mode, where Becky's going to go fucking murder them all in increasingly graphic and over-the-top ways. And it's a lot of fun. It's like it takes a little bit to get going. And so it's like a little bit sluggish in like the beginning of the film. But once we do get there to the point where she's actually murdering people, every kill happens in a way that was like so kind of like a little bit more over the top and a little bit more graphic and a little bit more comedically than I was expecting it was going to. So they all kind of caught me off guard a little bit and I ended up enjoying myself a whole lot. And again, you can't feel bad when you see Proud Boys getting murdered.
This just jumped up on my list. I assumed it was going to be a lot of fun. I was kind of curious to see, because like you say, one of the joys of the first one is the fact that it's this little girl just kicking Inglourious ass. So the fact that, you know, they find some way to bring her back and it's still kicking butt, I'm curious. I'll watch it.
And they also directly set up where a third movie in this series would go. And I'm just like, yeah, bring it on.
Just keep banging them. Exactly.
I'm here for it.
On a completely different note, the last movie I kind of want to mention is Tourist's Guide to Love, which is also on Netflix. And I pressed play on this because honestly, I just needed something kind of mindless and fun to watch. And hopefully something that was a little bit romantic, because I do have that streak. And this stars Rachel Lee Cook. She plays like the executive of a company that like buys, that basically has travel agencies throughout the world. And she's been sent to Vietnam to scope out this small mom and pop travel agency that the company might want to buy before somebody else scoops it up. So she goes to Vietnam on a fact-finding mission, but also because relationship reasons. And of course, she can't tell anybody that she's there as sort of like a double undercover agent So she's just going kind of through the motions as of this tour as kind of like the woman that demands a lot from her tour agent. And it turns into this really sweet little romance between her and the guy that runs the travel agency. It's nice. It's nothing particularly special. She's okay. He's great. Scott Nee, he's really, really charming. Definitely like big movie star material. I think the real highlight of the movie is Vietnam itself. Like Stephen Chinita, I think is his name, directed this. And he really does a beautiful job of just showcasing the city and the country. And I mean, if you hadn't already been interested in going to Vietnam after watching this, you might want to. It's just, it's so pretty. Like, it just looks like such a nice place to visit. So there is that. It's just a really picture-perfect postcard of a country. Is the movie any good? Not really. It's fine. I mean, it's okay. Like, it's not really romantic, even though it has the trappings of a romance and they do kiss in the end. It's just like there's really no romance. Like, there's no chemistry there. But it's a really pretty looking movie. I did find myself kind of like, oh, that's so nice. It might be nice to visit there. So, I mean, there is that, but it's not a really glowing endorsement, but it is what it is.
It is what I feel like is. I haven't seen Rachel Lee cook in forever.
Well, and this was the other thing when I looked it up. I mean, she had a whole thing in the 90s. Like, she was the it girl, one of the it girls of the 90s, and I'm not sure what happened to her. So I actually didn't recognize her until I saw the credits, and I'm like, oh, why does that name sound familiar? And then I had to look her up. And it's actually, I had the same moment watching Oppenheimer. I'm like, is that Josh Hartnett? Like, what the hell, man? I had one of those moments. But let's talk a little about a little bit of TV or streaming, one or the other or both. I think they're kind of the same thing at this point. And I wanted to start with The Crowded Room. Have you seen this?
I have not.
So this is on Apple TV Plus. It's an adaptation of a book by Daniel Kays, which is called The Minds of Billy Milligan, who is apparently a real guy. I had no idea. I went in this totally blind. And I went into it blind because it stars Tom Holland. And I thought, well, that looks interesting. But Amanda Seyfried was the one that's really sold me because I really love her and she's really not in enough stuff. So it stars Tom Holland as this guy who may or may not have multiple personalities. The show kind of reveals this in very slow progress. I think if you watch the trailer, which we hadn't, it kind of gives it away right at the beginning. But if you don't know anything about the story, it kind of is interesting the way that this series unfolds. There's 10 episodes. It's done now. The last episode aired like last week, so you can binge the entire thing. I thought it was really interesting. It loses steam towards maybe like episode 7 or 8. Like, it just gets like repetitive because you follow this guy in, again, nonlinear fashion, because you see what happens and then you meet the doctor and then it kind of jumps back and forth in time, trying to like show you how this guy became the way he is. And then you go into the trial, which takes the last like 2 or 3 parts of the series. And it's okay. Like, it works to various degrees. The performances are all excellent. I think it loses a little bit of steam in the last 2 episodes for sure. But overall, I think it is pretty decent. I understand that Netflix has a 4-part miniseries on the actual guy that the story is based on. And I was interested enough that I went doing a little bit of digging around and discovered that this Billy Milligan, the stuff that's in the show is quite different than what he actually did. So I think you could say it's inspired by... I'm curious to watch the miniseries because I think it would be quite interesting. But The Crowded Room is okay. Like, it's pretty good Tom Holland performance. Amanda Seyfried is fantastic. Jason Isaacs is in it for a short period. He's also great. Like, really good performances. The series just kind of loses a bit of steam towards them. So mixed results. Mixed results.
That's disappointing.
Now, you said Twist of the Metal, and I'm like, the video game? So of course I had to go and watch the trailer. I'm like, what the actual fuck is happening here?
Sony has been on this huge spree of trying to take like all of their brand recognition games and characters and turn it into media content. We of course got the Uncharted movie a bit ago. We got The Last of Us. We've got Gran Turismo coming out. There's, I believe, a God of War series that's in the work, as well as a Horizon Forbidden Dawn series in the works. And then here we have Twisted Metal. Even though we haven't gotten a new Twisted Metal game in like two console generations, the last one that came out was on the PlayStation 3. We've got the Twisted Metal series. I've always been a huge fan of the game series. I've always found it fun. It's car combat. It's cars with machine guns and missiles mounted on them, and you drive around various environments and try to destroy all the other cars that are in the arena and be the last man standing. That's basically what the game is. And it's a lot of fun. I enjoy the games. So what do you do with that for a TV series? Apparently this. I was so skeptical that this was going to work or be anything at all. And I'm not going to say that the show is entirely successful, but it is a lot of fun. And I think they actually like threaded a very difficult needle for the most part. What you basically end up with, the route that they took for this is it's essentially like a madcap Road Warrior, where it's a reverse escape from New York in the sense that like there was a big EMP that got set off in the 90s and we lost all power and internet and everything, which never really came back. And then the world fell to shit and cities turned into basically fortresses to protect the citizens, and anyone who's a criminal gets kicked out of the cities and you just have to exist with what's left of the world. And that's where we catch up with Anthony Mackie, who is basically just a delivery driver who drives between these different zones as, you know, as a job, and, you know, gets into car combat and, you know, to try and deliver stuff. And he's given this, this opportunity to basically retire as a citizen of New San Francisco if he just does this one run to New Chicago. And so that's what the entire series is. And he ends up picking up Stephanie Beatrice from Brooklyn Nine-Nine as basically his kind of unwilling partner, if you will. It's a very contentious relationship that they have throughout the film, but they, you know, form a deep bond along the way, and with a lot of fighting and arguing in between. And it's just like, it's a really interesting kind of absurdist apocalyptic story with a really kind of ridiculous tone. And I think it actually kind of works. I liked it.
The trailer is hilarious. I'm like, well, the tone is fun. So I might have to check this out. Also, I still can't believe it.
Also, it's fun seeing Anthony Mackie just be like fun and comedic, because we don't usually see that from him. He's usually like very serious.
Yeah.
When he's in roles. And then here he's like, he's doing a lot of comedy hijinks and aping, and, you know, it's actually like very delightful.
Is the entire series online now?
Yeah, it's all on Peacock.
Yeah. Okay. Good to know. Bingeable, bingeable, bingeable.
Yes, and it's only half-hour episodes too, so it's very digestible. I'm a huge champion of the half-hour episode of TV at this point.
I watched season 2 of 100 Foot Wave. So for those that don't know, 100 Foot Wave is an HBO documentary series from 2021 following Garrett McNamara, who is a big wave surfer and slash extreme surfer. Basically, the bigger the wave, the better. And the reason I got into this twofold, one, I just have an affinity for extreme sports, even though I don't participate in any of them. I like watching stuff about them and about the people that participate in them. And then the second part to that is that the 100-foot wave is actually about also the rise of surfing in Nazaré in Portugal, which has been a surfing hotspot for, I don't know, when they went out there like 10 years ago. And it, for a long time, Portuguese surfers have been talking about how there was this really great wave out there, but the world never really listened to them because they're surfing in Portugal. Like, that makes no fucking sense. So the first series, and I never thought that they would pick up after the first, I think there was six episodes in season one, because it kind of just like, it's about the discovery of this wave and then, you know, how it kind of Nazaré became a thing. So for season two, it's much less about McNamara and more about the surfing scene in Nazaré. And it makes for really interesting watch if you're into that kind of thing. I know it's not for everyone, but it's, the cinematography is fantastic. It's a really interesting group of characters. Like, there's, it's just, and that's one of the things I think fascinate me about extreme sports, is that it attracts interesting people, because you have to be a little bit off your rocker to do some of this shit. Like, it's not just everybody that's going to go out like hunting for 100-foot waves to surf. Like, you need to be a special kind of human to be even vaguely interested in that, which I think is also another reason why I appreciate it so much. So, yeah, it's the entire thing is now, there's six episodes. They're all streaming on HBO Max. If you're into this kind of thing, I highly recommend checking out season one and two. They're both really, really good. It's just fascinating television. I really enjoy this series. I think it's really great. And let's wrap with new Steven Soderbergh. So Soderbergh was kind of in the news because not only did Full Circle release, but I think the same week, he also released a web thing. I don't know how many episodes are in it because I haven't seen it yet. But it was like this thing nobody knew he had made. And all of a sudden it's online and you can buy it for $8. But that's not what we're talking about. We're going to talk about Full Circle. I don't know.
I haven't even heard about this other thing they did. I'm going to have to look that up.
I'll look it up while you're talking about Full Circle.
But yeah, Full Circle is basically a 6-episode miniseries. So it's like a 4-hour movie or whatever it is. Like, just a little bit longer than that. I thought it was just a really interesting thriller with a very unique concept, where basically it just deals with a kidnapping of a wealthy couple whose kid gets kidnapped. But the twist, and I've never really seen this before, is the kidnappers kidnap the wrong kid, and they don't actually have this rich family's kid. But at the same time, they want to protect this other kid who has been kidnapped. And so they're sort of like going along with it and trying to get this kid back. And it unravels in so many other ways that I don't want to go into too deeply, because it's like all the characters in this thing are incredibly interconnected with winding backstories, in that like nothing is really so much happenstance as it is like just exactly what the title suggests, that like, you know, what goes around comes around. And in a sense, like, what is being visited upon this family is sort of repercussions for a thing they were involved in years ago. And likewise, that it's just like, it's a vicious kind of like cycle of violence that just sort of continues in a way. It has an incredible cast that's in this thing. We've got Timothy Elephant and Claire Danes as the couple. And then Dennis Quaid as her father, is the empire that they manage. Got CCH Pounder in there, the matriarch of this Guyanese family that's basically a crime family, essentially, that's like bringing in essentially slave labor into the country and getting people to basically commit crimes to get out of debt, which is where we get to this kidnapping. And it really humanizes all of the people who are involved in the situation on all levels. This is Soderbergh working on the same sort of, like, he has different types of modes for films that he makes. And this is very much him working in sort of like the Traffic contagion mode, where it's this incredible kind of pastiche of a bunch of loosely connected characters whose lives occasionally intersect, and we're just constantly bouncing between their stories. And it's only once you get to the end that you really see how, like, all these stories make up one story sort of thing. And everyone's dealing with, like, their own shit. And I thought it was really interesting. I dug it a lot. I think it's definitely worth watching.
We watched half of the first episode, and I say half because Dan is like, I don't understand what's happening. This is really boring. I don't want to watch anymore. And I'm like, okay. So I reluctantly turned it off thinking, okay, maybe I'll just catch up with this later. And then the reviews were sort of meddling, and I'm like, but it's Steven Soderbergh, and I really like Steven Soderbergh. So I still have it on my list of things to watch. So I'm glad to hear you enjoyed it, because I think I will power through and kind of give this a go. But the first, for somebody that's not really like a more astute viewer, like, not to say that Dan isn't an astute viewer, he was really bored. He's like, I don't understand what's happening.
It doesn't have an immediate hook.
No, it doesn't.
You're either interested in these characters in general and what's going on in their lives, or you're not. And if you're not interested in the characters, in the same way, if you don't care about the characters of Traffic, I'm sure that's a very dull movie.
Exactly. So I will have to catch up with it. The other thing that came out at around the same time, it's called Command Z. And the conceit here is, and it's like a web series. I think there's like 7 episodes or something. The whole thing is only like an hour and 10 minutes long or something. But the concept is that a time machine is built in a washing machine. And these three people are jumping forward in time and back in time for a reason. The trailer is ridiculous. I'll link to the trailer. You, like I said, you can buy the entire thing off of Soderbergh's website. They kind of just dropped it out of nowhere. Okay. And of course, this is typical.
Michael Cera and Roy Wood Jr.
Yeah. And this is not unheard of from Soderbergh. He's often done things under the radar. I thought it looked really, really funny, and the conceit's just ridiculous. So hopefully I'll catch up with that before we talk again. But that was a lot of stuff. We covered a lot of material. Holy smokes.
I mean, we always do.
We always do. We
are efficient that way.
We are very efficient that way. So for everything that we talked about, we're going to have timestamps in the show notes. You can get all of that at atcpod.ca. We'll link to stuff that we talked about today. In the meantime, before we come back for our next show, where can folks find you? Where can they at you about your ill-conceived thoughts on The Flash? I'm kidding.
Oh, they can be very welcome to if they want. Easiest place to find me these days is on Blue Sky, where I'm at Ashley Lynch.
And you can still find me on Twitter, not tweeting, or whatever they're calling it now. I don't even know what it's called now. He changed the name of the app. I have no idea what it's called. But on that thing that used to be the blue tweet, the blue bird, and now is like this big black fucking X, I don't even know. Or on Instagram at TheMariaToo. And again, we'll be back in a couple of weeks with another show. So until then.
Insert catchphrase here.
Opening and closing credits are Happy Alley by composer Kevin MacLeod. For more information, visit incompetech.com.